Today is December 20th, 2019, and this is Sarah Desick interviewing John Reddick for the New York Preservation Archive Project. Can you start by saying your name and giving yourself a brief introduction?
Okay, my name is John Reddick. I've lived in New York City since 1980. I grew up in Philadelphia, a very diverse and interesting neighborhood that had a lot of historic fabric that dates back to the colonial era. So I always had interest in architecture and the physical environment.
Can you tell me more about the place where you grew up and the people you grew up with?
Well, I grew up in it's a very integrated neighborhood, and so I grew up with no consciousness of economics and intelligence being associated with race. And so it stayed me well. I went to all different types of schools growing up in different environments, and it felt like I could come and go. And then because of that, I always followed my interests. And so I went to a vocational high school, but realized I was interested in architecture and had to take some other courses to supplement that. But I went to interviews to be like an office boy or whatever, and I never thought, oh, as a black kid, I'm not going to get this, even though I go into an office that was all white or whatever at the time. I always felt I was rewarded by following my interests, and so I did.
Can you go into a little more detail about... Like you said, the area that you grew up in was integrated, and just give me some specifics about what that was like, the other people that you went to school with.
Well, it was called Mount Airy, my parents just by happenstance moved into that neighborhood. My mother grew up in a suburban town outside of Philadelphia where she and her sister were the only blacks in their class in the 1940s, and for some reason, she moved into the city where most of her cousins and stuff stayed out in that neighborhood that got developed in the post-war era to the more suburban life. And we were semi-detached houses in Philadelphia. There's almost an income house built for every income level. But our neighborhood, the way it sort of situated, went from sort of modest row houses to semi-detached houses to mansion houses. We had a very engaged principal in our public school who went on to be like an elected official. I had Ed Bradley, who went on to be 60 Minutes correspondent. He'd gone to Cheney, a black teacher's college, had been an intern teacher there and went on to become, come back to be a teacher. And in my mind, again, in New York, he talked about the principal recruited him. She wanted a male, black male presence in the school and all of that. So there was always a kind of consciousness and a balance. A large, I would say, sort of WASPy Jewish combination in that school. But then I went to a very ethnic vocational school with a real cross-section. So I found out, like, whites didn't like whites, like Poles and Italians or this and that, but something I never knew in my growing up of going to a more ethnic school. I realized that.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And the gentleman who taught the architectural graphics course had gone to University of Pennsylvania, had been an Olympic it was football, soccer player and all that. And he was very much known in the profession throughout Philadelphia. And so when he had real connections still to a lot of the offices. And so going to the office, like by 11th grade or so, you had like went to school half the day, worked in the office the other half the day. But I remember meeting Lou Kahn like in an auction house looking at books and him chatting with me about what I was looking at. And just really, I just felt like ideal. University of Pennsylvania had a lot of projects at U of P. I remember going there for, doing stuff for the office and all of that. Mm-hmm. And a very gentleman's firm. Other people later on told me it was Francis Kaufman, Wilkinson, and Pepper. And each partner had a real distinctive aspect in the office. And Mr. Pepper had been the grandson of the senator from Pennsylvania and the founder of the public library. And another one was more the business side. Another one was, Pepper was more the social connection side. Maybe only two of the partners really were at the drawing board overseeing any real drawing work. But they were really wonderful to work for. And I realized all the young people I've ever met since always tell them it's not about your resume, it's about enthusiasm. I realized I was just hired out of just, all high school, you're all really equal. You don't think that then, but it's being eager and enthusiastic that really makes the difference.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And so where did you go from there?
Well, I went to Ohio State as an undergraduate. And in fact, when I applied, Ohio State didn't take the SATs or something else. And I said Howard University, some other schools in Ohio State. And to this day, I don't even know why I had Ohio State on my list. But my counselor said, oh, you'll never get into Ohio State. It's a Big Ten school. I didn't even know what Big Ten meant. But because he said that, it became the focus of why I was going to go. He wasn't going to tell me where I couldn't go. And I had to take a different test. I had to sort of do some legwork myself. Neither one of my parents had gone to college, and so they were very, always extremely supportive, but all these things we were asking or talking about was sort of beyond what their experience had been, but they'd just always been very nurturing and encouraging. And I applied, I got in, I went to Ohio State. I had, we were a suite of roommates, four to a suite. I was the only Black, but I sort of anticipated I was going to be the only Black roommate, but they didn't, the other way around. It all worked out fine, but some of the parents, I can just remember the sort of fishy greetings and stuff like that. But, you know, it was fine. You know, overall, it was a really fine experience. And then I was there for 4 years. I worked a little bit, like after I graduated, for a short period with their public school system, the architecture office of their public school in Columbus, Ohio, and then applied to Yale. I didn't think I was going to get in the first route, so I sent my resume, I asked them to forward my, not my resume, my portfolio, and asked them to forward it to Penn, you know, that was the other place to apply. But in the back, I left a section for comments, and I think it impressed them that I left a section for, you know, that I was open to their opinion. And so, because when I got to Yale and I saw all the portfolios, like in the registrar's office when people apply, the whole room is nothing but shelves of all the applicants. You just wonder how they ever, you know, ever possibly make a decision.
And what, I guess, led you to study architecture? What was studying architecture like at Ohio
State?
Well,
my mom was very always artistic and creative. It was part of her volunteer engagement. She was a housewife for most of our early part of our education, so she volunteered for a lot of the school activities, and that was always one of her interests. So she was always demonstrating that, doing sets for school plays or whatever, just sort of engaged. And out of that public school involvement, she got a job working for a bank when they were trying to recruit African Americans. That wasn't her background. And it really changed her look at economics and savings. And back then, so we're coming of age into the late 60s, 70s, that was extra money in the household, which today is all rolled in one. But when she was buying a house, it was my father's income, not, you know, two incomes and all that. So it really helped facilitate paying for our college expenses and things like that. And where were we? And
so, what was it like to study architecture at Ohio State?
So Ohio State was, I mean, for a state that I expected to have a lot of African Americans, I mean, literally I could walk across the campus and not see another African American on campus, really not until the early, but around the time I was graduating, you saw a greater presence. But I was there during the Kent State and the, you know, the sort of anti-war efforts. And I remember the architecture school was this, in the row of buildings just beyond the Oval where they had all the demonstrations. So I knew I didn't want to fail all of my classes, but I wanted to be in the spirit of the protest. So I would always go in, we'd go in the back way and submit our projects and everything for school and then demonstrate, you know, in the front part. But we still made sure we went to our classes. It was a sacrifice for my parents. I couldn't just think about, like, just not, you know, fulfilling that obligation even. I felt other ways.
Yeah.
But it was very, I mean, there you didn't, the class was, I don't know if it was 100 students or whatever, but you did your board. They had certain regulations of how you would make your presentation. You just put your work up and you saw it move around. You didn't talk about it. You didn't do anything about it, which was very different from the Yale experience.
And who did you study with at Ohio State?
Well, I said there's nobody really famous, except I do remember there was the Historic American Building Survey, which is there's an engineering survey and a building survey that's a federal project, and communities apply. They get the survey to come, and they would do measured drawings of historic structures. And Ohio State actually had the photographer for this group. They had a special kind of camera that could photograph buildings and diminish the perspective, so the photographs would be almost like you could do measured drawings almost off of the photographs, Mr. Borchers. And I think his connection gave the school this connection and inroad to be able to get applicants in the program. And so one summer I went to Indiana, another summer San Diego, what was the third one, Wyoming. And the towns would have laid out what they wanted you to measure. So I remember in San Diego, it was like Indiana had a house that was a Victorian house and another house that was shipped and was assembled on site. It had been made somewhere. And Indiana had an automobile industry, and it remnants of the Court automobiles up to factory buildings we'd measure. And so it was a range of things almost kind of predetermined by the local community. And it'd be like five students. One probably would be a historian, and then a historian on the team that was an adult, you know, professor type, and the architect type. And so they would supervise us, and we would measure all these buildings and do the drawings. And it's great. Every so often, I'll see something promoted, and I'll see the drawings from, you know, Habs or Hare uses document, you know, document drawings and stuff. And they still do it. Mm-hmm. Program, they still do.
Wow.
And I'm friends still with some of the people I did that with. And I took the train across the country when I did it in San Diego. It was just amazing. That's another thing. I mean, I hadn't been to Chicago. I had a little layover, and I could see all these great buildings that were built in Chicago of that early period that I remember, you know, talking about in school and all of that. And you could see how the country grew. I mean, literally, up to Chicago, you're just seeing the backsides of cities. But from Chicago on, you saw all that corn and wheat, and you realized why it was the broker city, the New York of that part of the country, and maybe the train station's on one corner, and five blocks away is the state capital or the city hall. It just deposited you in the centers of all the cities and that. And then I had gotten at a Goodwill, Truman Capote's In Cold Blood, and he talks about these areas I was going through, and he was just so right on in his descriptions. Literally, I was reading the book at the same time I was making the travel, and he was just so nailed, like the character of the plains and how far you could see, and you see storms approaching for miles and all of that. You know, so it was kind of neat. I enjoyed it.
I've taken that train too.
It's pretty amazing. Neat. I mean, Utah, I could see at night we were in the you know, the viewing car, and it's like being on the moon. You could see the shadow of the train go across the landscape, and everything's really neat.
Yeah. And then, I guess, tell me about finding out that you were going to go to Yale and what that transition was like.
It was great. But one friend of my mother's always thought, she said, oh, my son's going to Yale. And he thought I was studying to be a locksmith. They never heard of Yale. The Yale, the lock.
Oh, my gosh.
And I'd never been to New Haven. I applied, I'd never seen it. And so in the summer, I remember going to go get an apartment and realized, oh, my God, New England looks like New England. I got off the train and I walked to the campus, and there's three churches on the green in New Haven, and it's like something out of the Ez for Peyton Place or something, unusual. But I got advanced standing. It's a 3-year program because I had an undergraduate degree. I had a lot of the skill sets. I didn't have to take the first year. But I remember they had a teacher named Charlie Moore or whatever. He was like a really big deal. I had to go look him up in the library. I didn't know who even was, so some of the people. But I TA'd for Vincent Scully. I would say that was one of the two professors there that I felt were really significant. And for Vincent Scully, and one of the kids in my class was saying he was going to do this, teaching position. And I thought, well, he didn't seem very smart. No, he didn't seem any smarter than me. I won't say he didn't seem smart. And I thought, well, I could use the extra money. And if he's going to go apply, I would go apply. So I go apply, and I had a T-shirt that I had bought in one of these thrift stores out in the Midwest when I was doing the HAB stuff. And I'm wearing this T-shirt, and Scully was just chatting. He didn't actually do it like a test or anything. And so he asked me about Winnetka, all these questions about Winnetka. Like, I don't know. And he says, your T-shirt. And my T-shirt had said Winnetka on the back of it. I thought it was an Indian name or whatever. And later on, I looked up at some rich city suburbs or whatever. But he started asking me questions if I was in that group. But he hired me to do that. And I did it like three different times for him. And I don't think he thought differently than I ever thought. But he keened my vision to look at culture and the physical environment and all of that. And at the same time, I also took a class with Hugh Ferris Thompson, who looked at the African American imprint on, in art and culture, and so both of them are very dynamic speakers, and how to weave a story around architecture and culture, and it really has impact how I look at culture. They never thought it was looking down to make things accessible to people. A lot of times you're in a profession, you sort of say, "Oh, if I have to explain a mansard roof to someone who doesn't know," whatever, almost demeaning for them to feel like they have to go back to, Architecture 101. But to me, that's a delight. I feel like it's arming people with the tools to do the battle when I'm not in the room, then that's more of a goal for me than whether I'm superior or I'm talking about what they don't understand. I'd rather be connecting some way. So I always look for the, Scully used to always say, he might talk in German or something, but he'd always say, as you know. And I realized for the person that's heard it before, it makes them leave him alone. And for the person that doesn't know, they should pay attention. It's something they should have known. So I use that trick periodically. But I do feel it's important to me to connect and give people a sense of the history and the story. And look at a place like New York. I feel like the physical, the history is there if you really learn to look.
Mm-hmm. Can you talk now about moving to New York? What drew you to New York?
Well, I was at Yale, and I got a job working for the Connecticut Historical Commission, which was in Hartford. And I took the train from New Haven up to Hartford for an interview for this job. And it was in a historic house in downtown Hartford. This is like in the 70s. And so everyone's deserted the city. Cities aren't pretty, downtown is just working. And particularly Hartford, they never integrated the surrounding East Hartford, all this. So people worked in Hartford, but at night it was like this mass exodus. So it was like no movie theater downtown. Anyway, I take the train from New Haven. I get off. The old G. Fox, this great Victorian department store, was still there. I think there was like a sort of what today would be sort of like a health food kind of restaurant by the train station. And I passed some historic houses that the commission was actually in a historic house and everything. Oh, this is kind of a nice place to want to live. And I go into the lobby of the historic house, and the secretary pool and everything was on the ground floor, little lobby area, and all the offices were upstairs. And they had my resume and everything. And literally the gentleman comes downstairs, looks right past me, and asks, where's the applicant? Because I'm African-American. He denied it after. He's, oh, John, because they hired me. But, oh, I didn't do that, but he did. He didn't say, oh, you Mr. Reddick. He just asked the girls, women in the office, like, oh, where's Mr. Reddick? But anyway, they hired me. And I was hired to do the historic survey. They had files that were done in the 1930s under the WPA, and it was really focused on colonial period architecture. And so they wanted to know if those buildings were still there. Did I see, like, sort of frameworks for potential districts? So I did what they call, like, a windshield survey. I would get the USGS maps, and I'd go out and look at all these towns, look at what was documented, you know, let them know it was still there or not. Take a series of, like, snapshot photographs. And then on those maps kind of give indications of what could be potential district areas. And it was neat. After a while, I mean, there were these really early factories because of the water power. And then by the Civil War era, if they were doing fabric or something or, some, you know, guns, whatever, for the war, they had this big burst, you know, and they built this new building. So you see these stone buildings that came later on. But you can see the whole social order of the towns because by the factory were the gridded off houses for the factory workers. And then, you know, downwind, I guess, or up downwind from the, you know, be up the hill would be the manager's houses, the boss's houses going up the hill from the factory. And so after a while, I could look at the USGS map and not even get to the town. I would pretty much guess what the town, the layout was going to be and stuff. But it was pretty amazing. And it was in the during the depressed period of, like, a lot of urban life. So a lot of these towns are virtually abandoned and stuff like that. But it was really interesting. Mm-hmm.
Was there a lot that was still similar from the 30s?
Oh, yeah. There's every time I see some old friends, I just reunited with some friends from there. And I just said, you know, they always ask me, what was your favorite town? I would say Willimantic. It was a town that just had all the, you know, you could do a, you know, a movie around that little town. It had all the fabric of the different aspects of the town were all still there. Very picturesque.
And then moving to New York City.
Well, I was still working there, and I was still doing some. Scully had gone on sabbatical, and he came back, so he was oversubscribed. So even though I wasn't at Yale, I was still going back, and I did another TA round for him, you know, because I was working as a consultant really for this other, for the state office. And I just started driving down. Ted Kennedy was running for president of the United States, the primary part of that. And I came to New York and volunteered to work in the office. I'd come down and stay a few days and, you know, work and all that. I just decided I'm going to bite the bullet. This is like 1979, 80 period. And so that's what I did. And it was a very kind of depressed time in New York. But when I came to volunteer, there was an African-American gentleman who was also volunteering. And you couldn't tell who was part of the New York campaign and who were part of the Kennedy campaign that was moving from each campaign. You know, there were ongoing campaign workers who were going from one campaign to the next. And so he couldn't, this African-American guy, he had theater, he was with the Schubert organization, and he brought a lot of his friends to come and lick stamps and put events together, whatever. But he couldn't figure out initially, was I part of the ongoing team or what? So it was like this little dance before we kind of got to know each other. But him and another person we'll probably talk about later, Karen Phillips, there's two people I can't imagine my life in New York if I had not met those two people. Because he knew so many people just right off the bat. He was so engaged. Robert LaPrince was so engaged with the city. He's passed away. He was one of the victims of the AIDS epidemic. But I just knew so, even now, in certain circles in African-American culture, you bring up his name, they remember him for events and things that he did and stuff like that. So I never had like a feeling like a disconnected minute in New York. So once I moved here, I just felt like I was sort of in the swim of what was going on and all that. And then for MAS, I would go to things at Municipal Arts Society. I can't remember what sort of committees on periodically or whatever, but I still felt connected in that way. I remember Mount Morris Park. They had a ceremony at MAS in Mount Morris Park where they honored this group of women who were trying to get their building on the National Register, which still is not National Register, but it's a landmark. 41 Convent Avenue was trying to get landmarked. And it was such a struggle. And I remember Jackie Onassis coming over and saying, well, you know how tough the bureaucracy can be to them at that ceremony.
Was the building, were they trying to landmark it for?
It's still there, and the tenants, they gained control. It was one of those buildings that got, so it fell under the ownership of the landlord and became a tenant-controlled building. So it's still like a rent-stabilized or tenant-managed building. And they got some resources to do things, but they never got it landmarked.
Mm-hmm. And I'd like to know, specifically, where in Harlem did you settle, and where were
I had a family friend who lived just off Convent, like 147th and Convent Avenue. And so we'd come visit her periodically. She was my age, so, I'd kind of be in New York, Patsy, check, And it was such a nice neighborhood, and I kind of saw, I knew she had a reasonable, she worked for the New York Times, but she had a very reasonable rent, a very spacious apartment. So when I just started looking around in that area. And back then, realty people would put, building management by. And I kept seeing A.J. Clark was a realtor. His name kept popping up in a lot of, but in other places in New York, they were on Gramercy Park. I remember seeing a name or whatever. But I went in their office. They had an office on, was it 57th Street? It's the through street, which is the through street, 59th or 57th Street, where it went Hard Rock Cafe and ended up being that building. And the building has since been demolished. But you actually went up, and there was Mr. Clark. I mean, it was still the family. And I sort of said what I could pay and all of that, this is kind of like, and I got a one-bedroom apartment for like $175. and it was to the back of the building. So I was on the fourth floor, back of the building. And I told people, back then you had, security bars on the windows because people could come up the fire escape. And everyone could look in. So I almost never opened the blinds because you're looking into the back of the building. And I told people my refrigerator, sun came and hit the refrigerator in my kitchen like 4 days a week. It was like Stonehenge. I walked in my living room and my refrigerator was aglow in the morning. It was a certain period of the year. I can't figure out when would the sun be the highest. I guess like in the middle of the summer, there would be this glow on my refrigerator. But anyway, I'm still in that building. Moved and got a bigger apartment in that. I'm still on the top floor, Riverview of in that apartment, but I'm still in that building for a very modest rent. It's still a rent-stabilized building. And I was able to leverage because I was moving out of my apartment and this woman and her mother were moving out of this bigger apartment. I could leverage the landlord giving it to me because he could raise the rent of two apartments as opposed to the rent of one. And my small apartment ended up being the most expensive apartment in the building because those are the apartments that turned over the most.
Right.
The bigger ones, nobody moved. So probably even today, those apartments on that line are more expensive than the bigger.
Wow. That's wild.
The politics of real estate.
Yeah. It's in this job is where I hear about people who haven't moved in 30 years.
Well, when I moved, and people said they lived in an apartment 15 years, 20 years, like, oh, you must be kidding. And I can't imagine. And I wish I had bought something. I had access to knowledge, I should have bought something. But after a while, like I'm saying, if I couldn't buy an apartment as nice as what I had, why would I leave? And now I'm glad I'm there. It's very accessible. It's an elevator building.
Mm-hmm. And what was your awareness of Harlem before you moved there?
When we had family, my parents had family friends, the people, Oscar Bembo and his wife, her name escaped me, but the husband and wife were really good friends of my godmother. We spent our summers in Virginia with my father's first cousin. And she had friends in New York. She had worked in New York and made connections in New York. And periodically she'd come up and visit this Bembo, Oscar and Bertha Bembo. And they were like the first blacks to live in their building at 135th and 7th Avenue, across the street from, you could look out their window and see Small's Paradise. The club was there, but it was also like a small like office building that had this club on the ground floor and everything. And their mother, she lived, Mr. Bembo's mother lived to be like 100. And she was 100 before the Statue of Liberty was 100. So I was like so shocked when the Statue of Liberty turned 100. Like, oh my God, Mrs. Chestnut was older than that. She can remember the neighborhood being rural, you know, and moving there really early on when it was like a really early development stuff. Mr. Bembo was a Garveyite and all of that. And she lived in that building forever. And they talk about like traditions like, you know, that neighborhood was still largely Jewish when they were moving in. It was because that Harlem was the second largest Jewish neighborhood in New York, second only to the Lower East Side. And they would say certain things that they couldn't, Jews couldn't do on like on either the holidays or the Sabbath, and they would go turn the light switch or do whatever it was that they couldn't do. So it was like a lot of cross-cultural history between when I talked to the older people, even like La Marqueta. And everyone thinks it was Hispanic. Well, it did start selling Hispanic product, but it had been Jewish vendors there. When the neighborhood changed, they didn't just leave. They stayed Jewish vendors, but they sold plantain instead of bananas or whatever it was, you know. So there was still a Jewish presence there.
So you didn't just know the neighborhood. You knew its history.
Well, I felt comfortable there. You know, as an African-American, I just, you know, it was a nice neighborhood. I felt calm. I didn't bother me living around African-Americans. And, you know, I knew I had a spacious apartment. You know, all those things were hard to come by. It was a picturesque neighborhood. If color was the only thing keeping people out, that wasn't keeping me out. So.
And what were some of the places that became important to you in your neighborhood or in Harlem?
Well, I went to a lot of different churches, you know, and like Riverside Church. It was like, to me, Riverside Church was like going to college still. It was still too political. You know, they had Guatemalans in the basement, you know, or like whatever, you know, some whatever persecuted group. But and not that I didn't like it, but it wasn't like church I had known growing up. And so I, in the end, gravitated to Abyssinian Baptist Church in Central Harlem. I really kind of liked going there. I liked the fact that it had like a history. It was an institution. Besides just the religious life, it was an institution. And at that period, the pastor there wasn't Reverend Butts, but it would become Reverend Butts. He was the assistant pastor at the time. And he had already had a long, it was the first and only job he ever had was with Abyssinian Baptist Church. He graduated from Morehouse College. He was assistant pastor when I knew it. Through my friend that I talked to you about from the Kennedy campaign, Bob LaPrince, had known him from Morehouse College. So even that was a sort of entree at a level with the assistant minister that I probably wouldn't have had as a Cole, you know, just a new parishioner. And then it was a lot of stuff. Vernon Mason was running for DA, just lost very closely against Robert Morgenthau. I just felt there was a lot of energy in my contemporaries there. And they were starting to set up my friend Karen Phillips, who I got to know, was the establishment of the Abyssinia Development Corporation. And the friend Kevin Magruder was with LIS, also worked with that, with the Development Corporation. They all had interests in history, and that the church had a great history. So it just brought me more on board with sort of preservation issues. It was compatible with some things I was already thinking. And then I did work for the Abyssinia Development Corporation. And at the time, the gentleman who's now head of the Ford Foundation, Darren Walker, was working there as an administrative person and all of that. So, wow. So it was always an
mm-hmm. And what sort of work did you do there?
I just sort of was like a target project stuff. So they were doing, Karen was trying to do some applications to get federal monies and different monies around preservation dollars. They started doing a big fundraising event once a year. And Darren and I remember really working on just like outreach to bring people into that. They were doing Esther Rowe. Mrs. Esther has sort of targeted that. Karen always felt that the reputation of the church, it wasn't like her skill set that got her access. It was the, within the confines of New York and the reputation of that church and its leadership helped them develop that development corporation. And in fact, it's very interesting, David Dinkins had been the mayor, and then Giuliani ran against David Dinkins. And partly why Giuliani won is because at the time, Staten Island wanted to secede from New York. And even though legally it couldn't happen ghost chance for it to ever happen, Giuliani supported it because he realized if they turned out for Borough Pride, they were more likely to turn out and vote for him than they would David Dinkins. And that's what happened. And Giuliani came in, and blacks hadn't supported him, Hispanics hadn't supported him, so his minions just knew that anything black and Hispanic wasn't a high priority. And then on the governor level, it just so happened that one of the members of Abyssinia Baptist Church was supporting George Pataki, who was running for governor, who nobody ever heard of. George Pataki, at the invite of this person, came to Abyssinia Baptist Church, and he wanted to speak. It's right before the election. He sort of make us, and he came and started to walk up to the altar area where the minister speaks. And Reverend Butts directed him to speak down at those, the parishioner level at the microphone. And so anyone who was a member there, there's other people who have come to the church. I won't name political people, whatever, but they were more than welcome to go right up to the altar to speak. So we realized it was like a lukewarm. The membership was like a lukewarm endorsement. This is something we have to do. We're doing it. But it was a saving grace for Abyssinia Development Corporation because now Pataki did get elected. It was one of a few, if maybe the only black church he'd ever gone to. And that's the only reason the Development Corporation could move forward, because Giuliani was putting the screws on them left and right, and it's state funding that allowed them to move ahead. So even when they did the Pathmark project, Abyssinia came to help an East Harlem organization because they were mired in what it would take to do it. And what people don't realize is, like, for anything, when you fight the city or anything, or a rich landlord, time does not work for you. You don't have the financial resources. These people have lawyers on retainer. It costs them no more to fight you than anybody else. The people, it's already built into their overhead. But for a little organization, it's really rough. And they came to help this group out, and it still took a lot of time. And when it got down to the wire, Giuliani had the head of the Development Corporation, Karen Phillip Lockton, in an office. He said, I'm going to go out of this, you have an hour. I can say the deal fell through or the deal's proceeding, but you have to give up 51% to an entity yet to be named. Then you could say it was a Hispanic, it could go to a Hispanic organization. And that's what she had to do. And he never named anybody. Hmm. You know. But just to politically say it's going to be designated to another group. And his minions, just like in the Donald Trump, like once those type of people verbally speak out against you, their minions know they can never say anything nice about you. So if your application's coming in, if Abyssinia didn't cross the T or dot an I, it was a reason to turn it back. They know that he does not want to go to any ribbon cutting with your name on it, and you'll never be in any ribbon cutting where he goes. So they were really saved by that connection with Pataki.
Mm-hmm. Wow. I guess, can you talk about, you mentioned this on the phone a little bit, places where you've had connections that have really enabled you to do the kind of work that you intended to do around memorials?
Well, that happened, again, Karen Phillips, because they had this political visibility, and there was money coming through ICE-T, Transportation Enhancement Funds. And I was toward the end of the Clinton administration. Clinton was in very good with Charlie Rangel. There was this money out there. And the politicians approached Karen and Abyssinia if they would be interested in, playing for like the Gateway Project to Harlem. They want to do something on 110th Street. And she thought it was way beyond what she had capacity to do. But she said, John, Betsy Rogers is thinking of leaving, is planning to leave the Central Park Conservancy, and she wants to start this initiative looking at public space enhancement with the tools she learned from Central Park. So I went down and talked to Betsy Rogers, and all the stuff with, Karen has this thing, she says, if you're an African-American, you had the USDA meat stamp, you should make sure you let people know you have the USDA meat stamp. And so I talked to Betsy Rogers. She thought I spoke well about architecture, and I mentioned Vincent Scully. She said, oh, Vincent Scully. And I said, oh, no, I went to Yale. I could feel myself clawing my way up the ladder. And she said she was interested in applying for this thing with her program. And she put me in touch with this woman that worked for her, a community outreach person, Irena Stennett, who I'm still friendly with, now works for Bloomberg, a big Bloomberg. And the two of us, all, totally on spec, she didn't pay, well, Irena was always already under her payroll, but for me, it was no money. And Irena and I, we had never met each other before. I thought she was, I didn't even know she was African-American. I thought Irena Stennett, Central Park Conservancy, she was going to be white. She was, and she was African-American. And she's very opinionated and very, you know, specific about everything. So after we got to be friends and I got to see her work ethic afterwards, I couldn't believe we never had a crossword or anything the whole 2 weeks we had to, 2 or 3 weeks we had to crank that out. But she did the, she knew the political players and what paperwork we need to get from them. I was writing the proposal side and pulling in documentation and all of that. And we put in for it and we got the money. And even today, if you walk along the four sides of Central Park, the most enhanced streetscape, not just the inside of the park, but the sidewalk, the improvements, both sides of the street, the residential side as well as the park side, the circle, we got funded through the feds. No other side of the park could get any federal money like that. Because they said, why isn't the Central Park West? They don't need money from the feds, Fifth Avenue. They would never get it. So it, we weren't billionaire contributors to Central Park, but you, leveraging the political wherewithal and everything. And Betsy's ability to hang in there financially, once we got the grant, but once the money has to come through an agency, and once the agencies got the money, they didn't want us involved. I mean, literally, they would try to shut us out of meetings. They brought in other consultants to diminish our role and all that. But I could stay in it because Betsy had the wherewithal to keep me in the game. And I was respected by the people in the bureaucracy. So the guys, the construction guys would call me up and say, John, you need to be at that meeting or some little hard thing. They realized I was really going to battle for them, and they really, I really, that was, you know, it was very rewarding. And just before that, or around the same time, I'm trying to think, I guess just before that, or pretty close to the same time, I was a neighbor to the people who lived with Ralph Ellison. And I'd already, I guess through my civic work, I'd already started being on panels, the New York State Council on the Arts and things like that for art review, the subway the enhancement, percent for art panels and all that. So, but I kind of understood what it would take to do public projects. And so when this group of neighbors to Ralph Ellison decided at 150th and Riverside, there's a little traffic island, that they wanted to do a memorial to Ralph Ellison, they asked if I would be on the committee. And this woman, Ann Dobson, who lived in the building, who really knew the Ellisons and all of that, they brought me on board. It was a committee of maybe about 10 of us. And she always talked about Shackleton's committee. And in the end, everyone on that committee at some crucial time had some access that made it happen better. Someone knew the one of the artists in the end was Elizabeth Catlett. And she was sort of prominent enough that she'd be out of the circle of anybody. You could send her letters, but we weren't hearing back to it, all that. And it taught me the lesson that you can stand back as an administrator to public projects if you spend the time to make sure really great people submit in the competition. Because excellence really does win. You know, a politician can have his niece that he thinks is a great artist or whatever it is, or something hokey. So like Mr. Ellison, I spent a lot of time showing the committee what types of things are public art. And Mr. Ellison wasn't Frederick Douglass, where you felt you had to see him as a figure. He was an intellectual and all this. It could be some graphic sculpture around writing. It could be all these different things. And it was great. So when we had people show those sort of finalists, one person said, oh, we're going to have Mr. Ellison sitting on a bench holding the Invisible Man, and kids can climb up in his lap and blah, 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 blah. And everyone said, oh, thank you. And when he left, people who really knew Mr. Ellison on the committee, his neighbors, were like, oh, he'd never have kids climbing up in his lap. So maybe 100 years from now, it would be some romanticized version of who he was. It was really, and we asked that they separate that project from another ongoing Riverside project, and the Parks Commission was willing to do it. Stanley Michaels was the council member at the time, very much a park activist. He was a reader and lover of jazz. Every time we needed any extra money or whatever, he was willing to help do it. Ken Smith, a landscape architect, you know, at very limited cost, helped do the landscape development stuff before it all got folded into the parks project and all that. So that was, for me, that was the dearest of all the public projects I ever did, because the planets aligned and made me think it would be much easier than it ever was after that. So, but it was really, really special.
think I want to go back. Well, let me ask about landmarking efforts that you've been a part of.
Well, that's I would say my career has been very frustrating because, like, for example, Abyssinia controlled the Renaissance Ballroom property. And because I worked with the Development Corporation, I knew how hard they tried. The catering company that took over all these banks around New York to turn it into catering facilities, they talked to them. Cipriani came up and looked, but the market wasn't right, maybe to make it into a catering facility. And it just, a lot of projects came and went, proposals, and nothing was happening. And the water was coming in. It was like, and finally, after Karen left, and the new director, they had a deal that they looked at was going forward where they were going to try to keep part of the facade and do this, you know, residential tower and everything. And I actually agreed, because they were calendared, but they had never been moved forward on the calendar. It had been one of those, that backlog of people had been on the calendar 20 years and never been. And I went down and spoke on behalf of letting them come out from under that so they could do this financial benefit tower, keep this facade and all of that. And then that deal collapsed in terms of, you know, in that time period. That was around the time that the economy took the downturn, whatever, 2000, whatever that was. And then that deal that proposed keeping the facade didn't happen. But now they were out from under the rigor of that, and it got demolished. The facility got demolished. And so I always feel bad that, you know, that I just didn't, you know, I felt empathy for the struggle and all of that, but then the economy did come around, and maybe, you know, they would have, you know, done better to have been able to save it. But also, I turned the block, and there's a whole block. When I started going to Abyssinia, there was all this abandonment across the street, and all these tenement buildings that probably they'll never landmark all got rehabilitated as affordable housing under that. And I remember going to Count Basie's funeral, whatever year that was, and all these news media people were there covering it. I was embarrassed to come out of the church, look across the street, and see the condition, the abandonment and stuff of all those buildings. So in some way, you know, it's a mixed bag. And I wish I maybe it was harder to the line around it, you know, at the time. But that was one that I sort of cared about, that I sort of felt. And they had the other project where they did build the school over the building that had the Smalls Paradise building. And the Smalls Paradise, the building that was part of, is still there. And you can see the architecture to that building, even though this is a larger building over top of it. So you can comprehend that aspect. And I always feel like, and Harlem's still lacking a broader plan that looks at, if you're talking about the history of the African-American experience, and it's the flagship neighborhood for that experience in America, you know, the avenue that the soldiers came back after the First World War and James Reese Europe's band, what those soldiers realized their neighborhood looked like Paris after being to Paris, all those things. When I turned 110th Street and come up that avenue, I still feel the impact of what that was because of my Scullyisms and my sense of architecture and all of that. Or when they did the protest march against lynching and all the churches marched down the avenues, turned down Fifth Avenue, and went down Fifth Avenue to the headquarters of the NAACP. It might mean nothing to all the other paraders, but imagine what it meant to people in Mississippi, who, if you ever look at those lynching photographs and realize kids, women, everybody are there, and nobody's hiding their face. Those cameras aren't like our cameras. You saw the flash go off. You knew the camera was there. You knew you were never going to be called to testify or anything. So pictures of black people marching down Fifth Avenue, the most famous American street in America, and be able to come back to their churches, still have their jobs, still live, their neighborhood wasn't burned to the ground and all that, what that liberty meant about Harlem to them and all of that. Looking out your window of a tenement, it's the 2,000 block of Fifth Avenue in Madison, but it's not to your cousin in Mississippi. It's still Madison and Fifth Avenue, and you're seeing the Empire State Building, which is like a Ginger Rogers Fred Astaire movie view. You're seeing from your roof or your tenement apartment, all that. I realize how empowering all that must have been for my ancestors. So try to keep some aspect of that together. And that still has not happened in Harlem. And to live under the current Trump administration where if it's not visible, it doesn't exist, how it can be so easily dismissed. And African Americans never had a lot of wealth. And all that. So what might seem like minor, you know, buildings and architecture to the, you know, the writers of landmarking is not insignificant to my community. And I go to, I was in South Carolina, and we went to a plantation house and Drayton Hall. And it's a beautiful plantation house, and they talk about it. But when we're leaving, we'll say, oh, we're going to do a little presentation if you want to, you and your friend want to come. So we went over to the presentation, and one of the first slides she showed was an ad for a slave sale from an old newspaper, and it says West African rice knowledge. That was the first time in my life I realized the cultivation of rice, the cash crop of the Carolinas, did not exist. The blacks from West Africa realized it was ripe for that, you know, cultivation. And so they only, and partly why there's the Gullah culture of people speaking the same language and all that, is because after that they only wanted people from West Africa. So in other plantation cultures where the blacks couldn't even speak to each other, Africans couldn't even speak to each other, here it was this homogeneity because they needed it to make. So the lazy guy sucking the Mick Julep on the porch had nothing to do with his wealth building, not in the work, not in the intellectual knowledge or anything. And when you leave that plantation house, nothing's preserved. It gives me any inclination that there was 1,000 slaves that had to live. There had to be a community of housing and everything for those people. I've yet to be anywhere where there's any mapping that gives you any indication of the proportion of the workforce it took to make that possible, the acknowledgement of that. So to me, all those things, you can't tell that story without being able to physically make it, you know, visible to people. You know?
Mm-hmm. And this is kind of sticking with that idea. What is the importance of making historical narratives visible, especially for people who've been marginalized?
But not just marginalized, the humanity of the experience. Like when I start talking about Carlin's Black and Jewish History, and when people are like, well, why would blacks and Jews, why are the same neighborhood even be interested to one another, whatever? But I could go back to the fact that the Chicago Exposition, one of the cities considered for that exposition was New York. And they proposed the northern end of Central Park, the southern end of Harlem, which was just starting to be developed, over to the Hudson River. And they said, oh, they started saying, oh, the Heights could be the Acropolis of Manhattan, and we'll have part of the fair there and down to the river. You know, we didn't get it. It's just like Hudson Yards. Hudson Yards was talked up for the Olympics. It didn't happen. The energy focused development on the Hudson Yards, and that's what happened in Harlem. So now Columbia wanted to come, St. John the Divine, that Beaux-Arts, with a grid where there's no building that focus on the axis. Well, in Harlem, Riverside Church, St. John the Divine, Grant's Tomb, all pick sites on Riverside Drive that allows you to visit their visible way across East Harlem and all that. So I could talk about the beautiful city, the Beaux-Arts aspects by walking down the 121st, 123rd Street in Harlem and look across and make people realize that. Or, you know, or the Heights, you know, I had to give a talk about Hamilton's house, and they just want me to talk about the house. And I go, well, what could it have been like? And I went to Manahana, that book that looks at all the topography and the chain. And I realized, oh, my God, he went to the Shefflin family. He wanted to buy the land, not just the hillside, but down to the river. And I realized, oh, my God, back then, his house at the top of that hill saw the Palisades. And the Palisades looks just like Nevis. Nevis is where he's from. It's a volcanic island with all the development along the riverfront and these sheer cliffs going up. So I realized he had some romantic relationship to the landscape, you know. So all those things help tell a story, why the land was valuable, why the nicer apartment buildings are on the hillside and facing the park, why the elevated train and the tenement houses are on the flats and all that. So if you can feel it, it's like someone, I've never been to Niagara Falls, but someone says, you feel the falls before you get to the falls. You can feel it in the ground. So you realize you're feeling what the Native American felt. I feel like those kind of stories are to make people feel it's visceral. And when it's visceral, they never lose that story. It's like a punchline to a joke. It's like it's the intellectual letting you realize I thought something, I was wrong, and now I'm laughing at how ridiculous my thought was. They never lose it. If I get someone on a tour, something to laugh at, some prejudicial thinking, rather than getting mad and angry about it, if I can sort of reveal how ridiculous that is in a sort of joke and stuff like that, I realize I've gone much further than if I got into an argument about it. So.
Mm-hmm. You'd said something when we were talking earlier about how a lot of Harlem history has been kind of ghettoized, mm-hmm. or African-American history has been ghettoized to Harlem, whereas there's actually been a lot more cross-pollination mm-hmm. with the rest of the city, which I think is sort of what you're saying. Mm-hmm. I just wondered if you could elaborate on
that. Well, right now there's a family whose name escapes me who has some association with Seneca Village. But they were like they had the property not really to live, but to rent and create revenue from. And someone told me that their house still is down, like, in the financial district, somewhere down there, either the building or they know they had a house in that area. And now everyone's saying, well, they had a connection to Seneca Village. They should put the statue in Central Park by Seneca Village, whatever. And so much interesting. I remember when the Seneca Village first came up, how they had almost no history about it. And now they've gained a lot more. There's some churches that moved to Harlem that had a connection there. There's much more about the sort of average Joe's life. You know, it represented a certain number of blacks because they owned land that could vote. And even though it seemed like a low number, against the number of blacks that could vote in all of New York State, they were almost like 10% of the black voting population. So it was not. And so I'd rather, to me, that's a more interesting story to talk about Seneca Village than about the people who, even though they were black, were profiteers off of it. And if their house still exists in the financial district, to me, showing that a black person got in the financial district when you think it was all white, that's a more interesting story to me. The prod people out of their kind of conception that all these things, particularly in a city like New York, where these things are always sort of cross-pollinating, there's a chance to demonstrate that there was this presence outside of the obvious. And to me, that's a more interesting, when you can only do little notes around the city, it's more interesting to strike a note that sort of makes people think differently than just play to the obvious, Not to say that my own cultural history is invaluable in my neighborhood and stuff like that, but I feel like in Harlem, it really spoke to this broader accessibility about the average Joe. My parents, who were couldn't stay at any hotel when they honeymooned, stayed at the Teresa Hotel. And so to talk about that in, context with Fidel Castro coming up there, what it meant to be a sort of a renegade in that neighborhood and what that meant about having this facility, the broad-based meaning of it means more to me than a singular story. So someone who did the American thing of getting land and profiteering and taking that land and being able to not live with black people but live in the midst of where wealth was, if somebody was able to do that in the 1800s, I would rather hear that story told in that neighborhood and the oddity of that in that neighborhood so people start to think that that's possible than just sticking to, ghettoizing it. And so right now, this whole political political agenda, we have to make up for something that didn't happen. And just saying, what's a famous black square? And then we're going to sort Shirley Chisholm there, or this one there, or that one there. It's just like naming the streets. It's Martin Luther King Boulevard, or it's Malcolm X. But if the city really believed that, then why isn't Malcolm X Boulevard the whole length of Manhattan? So why is it just in my neighborhood? And why, if you look at the maintenance of that street, it looks totally different when it's Central Park West. Frederick Douglass Boulevard doesn't look the same after it becomes Central Park West. It's like I'd rather see equity and see it continue and maybe have maybe a couple less streets named for my ancestors, but the beauty of the continuity moves to the neighborhood and just sort of like window dressing. And some of it, I think, is just turning into window dressing and the history is moving aside, or what seems to be popular history and not a deeper sense of what that history can tell. I think that's a greater challenge to be looked at and talked about.
Mm-hmm. And then I think there is also, too, that the audience, the presumed audience for Malcolm X Boulevard or Frederick Douglass Boulevard is...
Well, if you ghettoize it, you're making it true. That's the whole point.
Right. Exactly.
It's just like, exactly. And I have tours, and inevitably, someone will come up to me, and we're talking, we get to the Apollo or whatever, and change, and they say, I haven't been to New York in Harlem in so many years, but did you know, I came up in 1970, and I saw, James Brown at the Apollo, blah, 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 blah. So I'm supposed to know, even though I haven't said this, despite all the negativity about coming to Harlem, I went against that tide and I came, and I'm supposed to, that's supposed to be my bonding thing with the person who said it. I'm going to say, I go to the Metropolitan Museum. No one pats me on the back. I go in the, minorities go into communities where they might not be welcome all the time to work, to get aspects of the culture and all of that. And no one, says we're exceptional or pats us on the back about it. And so I was saying, one time in 20 years isn't enough. If you really care about bridging the gap, you have to be willing to go somewhere where you think you might be uncomfortable, because most likely you won't be. Because African Americans know if a white person is wandering in Harlem, he's there because he's interested in my community, or he either loves my community and culture, or he has a lover in that community, and they're treated pretty well. There's no way groups of blacks could go to churches in white neighborhoods the way they come to African-American churches, just on this expectation. To this day, I don't know what they expect, but the line at Ebbesen is as long as it would be for the Empire State Building. You know, and we allow you to come in and have that experience. While some people ask me afterwards, is it safe, you know, to walk around or whatever? I said, well, you think those people ascend into heaven and demonic people come out on the street, you know? But it's all there. So part of the tools of doing that, but for me, I'm saddened because I go into offices now and I see less of a minority presence than it was when in the 1970s. I go into architecture firms and places like that. You know, it's just, it's appalling, really. For a generation that thinks it's all over with. You know, when people told me when Obama was elected and now it's a colorless society or whatever, I said, well, let me say that. Let me be the one to tell you that it's changed. Yeah. You know, just the perception isn't the same as the... Baldwin says, you say, well, show me the evidence. You tell me all these things, but show me the evidence.
Mm-hmm. Why do you think that there is less of a minority presence or less integration than there was in the 70s and 80s in these?
Well, first of all, I always look at the post-war period and what the GI Bill did for my parents. And so the Second World War, they made the same sacrifices. The Kennedys and the Bushes made the same sacrifices as my family. The Kennedys even lost a son in the war. And they were entitled, just like my father, to a GI Bill for education or to buy a house. Nobody was selling my father a bullshit house. He maybe couldn't live in any neighborhood, but they didn't say because the banks, the feds are underwriting this mortgage here, or you give me a Trump university diploma, whatever. And if, when I look back at the civil rights movement, part of where we were able to advance is because we had the credentials. You know, they had become teachers, they had become accountants, they had the tools to move forward. And so whether you were Italian or Irish or Jewish or black, you could take advantage of those things to go to City College, do whatever it was. My uncle went to Howard University with David Dinkins. All those people were able to move forward through some equity. So by the time I went to Yale, for example, I was ready to graduate. I was number 6 in the draft when I was, that was my draft number. And I was like, oh my God, you know, I'm going to get drafted to a 1, to all my rich classmates. They couldn't figure out why I was even worried. They go, don't you have a doctor? Don't you have an allergy? Don't you have bone spurs? You know, and so that sense of like everybody being in it, and I'm not just talking about being in it and paying lip service to it. There was a kind of evenness in all of that that allowed for an advancement and for our parents to all aspire for us to do better. I was going with working class white kids that were just as enthusiastic as shots to go to Yale and all that. And I had a reunion with my classmates from Yale. We couldn't even remember. I paid my graduate education. I had some scholarship and I paid for everything. I had maybe a little debt afterwards and we could not remember what our tuition was. That was not the barrier to going. It was the exams and getting in and all that. So I do feel sorry for this current generation because I feel like that sense of like fairness, like built into the system in a certain way. I'm not saying it was perfect and all that, but there's certain things about the equity. Like all those bank loans, the people that talked someone into, no poor black man or Hispanic came in and asked for a balloon mortgage. You know, someone talked him into that because they didn't want to know your salary. If you said you were an architect, they went to the median salary for architects, and that's what they wrote in on the bank loan and all this. So they knew, you know, they were cheating people and they didn't really care. And none of them went to jail and all that. And that wasn't the people who they're pointing the fingers at. It's their money that not only they lost their house, but the government bailed out the bank that gave them that mortgage. That house got sold when the economy changed. They sold it a couple times for an increase or whatever, all on the backs of the very people whose taxes and stuff were, you know, paid for it. You know? Mm-hmm. So I do hold that against Obama, that nobody went to jail for that. Or he should have made them, if they were good enough to walk in the door day one, then you have to renegotiate all those mortgages, you know.
Yeah, there's a whole generation of people who were, that system didn't work. It was used against them in a way, and then another
generation.
And so the
generation, bottom line, and it was the same people, the same bankers and stuff that were getting, I mean, the grandsons of the same people that gave the mortgage loans to my parents. And I'm not saying they could get into any neighborhood or whatever, but there was a fairness in the quality of the housing and the stuff you could get. You know, it wasn't like, you know, they were just giving you something that was going to collapse tomorrow.
Right.
Yeah. They were getting you into a house that they knew you could pay the mortgage for and all.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a huge difference. And maybe this goes back to one of the things we were talking about just before this, but were you involved also in Tin Pan Alley?
I was.
Can you talk about that?
Well, I have to say, George Calderaro, who is very active in preservation, he had been involved in a lot of Harlem cultural groups, and I've known him socially and professionally for a very long time. He lives in the area of Tin Pan Alley. I've been very much an activist. And I had become a Columbia Community Scholar. It was a program that was negotiated as part of the community benefits, a three-year program. And George is with the Continuing Education Department. And when I was completed my cycle, I was one of the first, or the first, to give a talk about my research and my interests in Black and Jewish music culture. And he orchestrated that for me, and he was so good about getting press and all that, that I started calling him Swifty, for Swifty Lazar, the agent. Because he was just so energetic. And so he said, John, I want you to come in, and we're trying to bring back to the Landmarks Commission this effort to move Tin Pan Alley. And I went, and I started talking about the Black and Jewish connection. And from my research, I had all the sheet music that had those addresses on it. I could show Black composers and all of that. So it was I wouldn't say it was all of the changing tide, but there was a new director at the Landmarks, and they were willing to sit down and kind of listen. And they could see it was advancing. And they called me in to talk a little bit about it. But then the kicker, when they started having testimony, the developer, I wish I could remember, when we correct this, I'm going to give you the actual name of the historian. But they hired a hired gun historian, Alpert. And he wrote testimony, and he had 12 images of sheet music, and he picked all the most horrible images, or like the cartoony kind of images of the period. But almost 8 of those pieces of sheet music were actually African-American composers. Maybe 4 of them actually had their picture on the cover of the sheet music. And the fact that he was going to take my history, use it to shame either whites that didn't know or felt nervous about speaking up if no Black was in the audience to rally around it, or make Black people who weren't aware of it just look at those pictures and say, oh yeah, this is horrible or whatever. When in reality, the fact that their name was printed on it, and that maybe this one time they had to tolerate that, but if that song became famous, the person wouldn't go to the music publisher. They would go to John Reddick or Lou Smith or whoever it was that was the composer. And it was their first chance to be acknowledged for what they did. So some of those guys we talk about in the old days, you'd go, they like your tune, they'd pay you $25, and you were done with it. And Noble Sissles and Hubie Blake used to say, if they like my song and they gave me $25, I went and sold that same song to 5 other music publishers, let them fight it. And fight it out, you know. And so the fact that he did that, I found that was so reprehensible, him in his suits and well-tailored. Now here I am, nothing. I'm getting paid nothing to be there. And then he probably got tens of thousands of dollars to write reports. They so twisted my history. And so writing that rebuttal, to me, was one of the great efforts. And Sarah, I can't think of Sarah's last name, who read the when they decided they were going to calendar it to move it forward to Landmarking, and they had to read to the commissioners the justification for why, that an African-American young lady on the staff read it, and to know the tenor of what she was reading and how they used the African-American part, dealing with it and then taking it and showing it as a benefit for the community. I felt that was the greatest teaching lesson I had had all my, I really felt, and I felt she was armed. And she even said that even the complexity for her, even though they wanted to do it, the things she had to listen to in-house for why maybe not, blah, 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 blah. So I felt I armed another soldier in the battle. So it was a nice, mm-hmm. Nice feeling. But there's just so much of it, and there's so few of us in the profession. You feel like, everything's like this. It's a heavy lift, And to me, for all this that we were talking about, all this engagement, no one has approached me ever about being on the teaching staff of any institution in New York. They want me to talk to their students. They want me to validate some research they've already done that maybe has some overlap in Harlem, take a read this or what that. But it's the same thing. So I could say the same argument as anybody else. It's like I see other people out of nowhere, get jobs or doing things or whatever. And, so I feel like George is the only one where I feel like there was real, like genuine sort of professional engagement back and forth. And I know that if there was a fight, I could call him up and they were, but if you look at the preservation, even when I was working for Abyssinia Development Corporation, Columbia and City College both had programs that were around planning. that, you know, you could go to those programs and they would do statistical research and stuff to help the development corporations write grants or, you know, make their argument at other levels. Both of the schools had none of those programs anymore. You know, they're gone. And historic preservationists, Columbia has never done one report, or I've asked for students to do things. They said, well, John, students expect to get paid and they're not going to do it for free or whatever, you know.
I would like to talk about the LGBT sites movement to recognize and possibly preserve sites that are significant to LGBT history. And so I want to kind of talk about what NIPAP has kind of documented so far, and kind of ask you to weigh in on that and welcome you to critique it also. A few of the people that we interviewed were involved in this specific project, the OLGAD map of sites, and that was in the early 90s. And so I'm wondering, you know, either what were you doing at that time, and were you aware of that particular project, and what sort of sense did you have about preserving LGBT sites at that time?
Well, Michael Henry Adams is, for a long time, has been looking at the LGBT culture in Harlem. And both of us got to be very friendly with a gentleman named Marvin Smith. And there were two brothers, Morgan and Marvin Smith, twin brothers. One was gay and one wasn't. And Marvin Smith was still alive. And they did a big show at the Schomburg. And they had a book out. And so it's very funny. I'm going into the Schomburg. I was coming out of the Schomburg from seeing that exhibition. And Mr. Smith is coming in. I go, oh my goodness, that's Mr. Smith. So I kind of backtrack and come in behind him to say, oh, you're Mr. Smith, I saw the exhibit. And he's cruising me. And he's like in his 80s. Like, he's like, oh, what do you do? You know, so okay. And it turns out he lived near me, and we got to be very, very friendly. And he was very open to talk about sort of what the gay culture was like and different aspects of that. So he was probably like, and I've known other more mature guys that could have told me a little bit about him, and maybe one other, Bob Phillips, who was older, could talk a little bit about that older history. But for the most part, I came into New York, where even though the gay culture, I wouldn't say it was out, but the social culture in New York was so gay that the music culture and everything, so if you went to Studio 54 or whatever, you could be sort of closeted in a certain way and go to places that were gay, and you still say, well, I'm not gay, I'm just at Studio 54 or whatever. It was so much more integrated, even more than now in a certain way, in terms of like the high popular culture, it so embraced aspects of the gay music culture and everything that, you know, it was almost seamless in certain aspects of the city where you came and went and how things happened. And so many of the people that you knew were gay were part of the social order. Even me, I come to from growing up in Philadelphia, and all these guys that my sisters were, you know, mooning over that were soap opera macho guys were in all the gay bars. And so I think that was just very funny. So that's another thing about New York, the realities of what, you know, the image of what was going out, and, you know, and then who got picked on, like who Barbara Walters, you know, she knew, Calvin Klein was gay, and she, you know, Roy Cohn, but she would never expose them, but she would expose Ricky Martin or, you know, those kind of people. So they, even in knowing, they would pick and choose who they would put under the lens and who they wouldn't. Mm-hmm. You know, who's Rosie O'Donnell? It's like I would go to the fundraising events like for Bette Midler. She couldn't have been more like just crude and open about who she was in many ways. But Barbara Walters never, you know, she hired her on The View and all that, but she never had her, you know, the same that she did to Ricky Martin, she never did that to Rosie O'Donnell. And she acted like, oh, afterwards, like, oh, she knew and it didn't matter or whatever. It was like, but no, you never, you know, threw her under the bus the way you did people you didn't know or didn't really care.
Yeah, you didn't weaponize
it. Right.
When it was beneficial for you. So what did Marvin Smith tell you about?
Him and his brother they worked in the Central Park. You know, they were Shakespeare Garden in Central Park, the WPA. They came in the 30s. And they talked about the wealthy men that would approach them and stuff in the park. I think Marvin Smith got to go to Europe to meet somebody very wealthy. The famous actors, he would talk about, they would hang out at the clubs and things like that, you know, that sort of visibility. And Marvin Smith was one of those people, even to the end, you would not necessarily assume he was gay, and just his demeanor and all that. And so he would talk about someone like Billy Strayhorn, who was much more out. He was under the umbrella and protection of Duke Ellington. He said, oh, Billy Strayhorn used to make me nervous. He was so much more out about like who he was and all of that. So just the whole, how everybody sort of played the system. Even someone like Langston Hughes, like to this day, you don't really know for a fact what Langston Hughes' sexuality was. And so I did a talk at the Langston Hughes house. And I thought that was less interesting to me than the community of LGBT people he was around and how he, you know, Carl Van Vecht and all these different people that were part of his sphere of influence and how he engaged them and all that. And certainly the LGBT culture had an imprint on him. Or I went to see Falling Water, Frank Lloyd Wright house, and I go into the garden. There's a statue of an African-American woman in the garden. I go, ooh, who is she? And they tell me it's Rose McClendon. And I didn't know who she was. And who was the artist? Richard Barthay. At the time, I didn't know who they were. And when I went to look them up, both images of them were Carl Van Vechten images, because he always put fabric and things behind the images, so his DNA was on the photograph. And then the more I read, I was like, well, how did that happen? How did, you know, Frank Lloyd Wright, why would he hire, you know? And I find out it's not the Kaufmans built the house. The Kaufmans were a store, big store owning company in Pittsburgh. And their son, Edgar Kaufman Jr., was the one that introduced his parents to Frank Lloyd Wright. He became one of the founding collectors around decorative arts for the Museum of Modern Art. And then I did know the black sculptor, you know, out in the garden, but an earlier gift he gave his parents was a bust of himself that Barthay did. So I realized he introduced Barthay's work to the parents, and so we got Barthay two commissions, you know, but they were both gay. You realize they were in that social circle, and he was a peer that he saw equal to Frank Lloyd Wright. He wasn't just a sex partner, and I had no clue that they had any sexual engagement, but there was this intellectual sharing and community sharing and all of that, that nothing gets talked about. So that's the backfill I like to see in a lot of the storytelling, this aspect of, you know, gay players, someone like Gertrude Stein, which does Four Saints in Three Acts. She comes in and works with all these black artists. She rehearses in St. Philip's Church in Harlem. They see the spiritual side. If the 20th century was about the sciences, it was also about spirituality. So there's a Freud and looking at dreams and all of that. And you look at Picasso's paintings before the Mademoiselle d'Avignon, it's just very, you know, rigorous and every fold, everything. And then he goes to the museum and realizes what was considered crude was actually speaking to him. Those masks were scaring him or making him laugh. And he realized psychology, these other things. And so the black culture became something they were very much interested in. So Matisse, when he comes to America, all these people come there. And for the outsider players, that's the one more bonding thing, you know, the experience, the black experience, and where that's going to take them and all of that. So there's a lot of LGBT through the arts and stuff. If you look at dance and all that, they're making these connections. So you don't have to go far afield. You can look at the same stuff you've been looking at all along, but realize that these people weren't just sex partners. I think it gets diminished, the very, you know, sexual connections and the intellectual fact that they're even in the sphere with one another gets diminished. You know?
Mm-hmm. And that, in fact, they were peers.
Yeah. Philip Johnson says his first lover was an African-American guy named Billy Daniels, who was running a club called the Bonsoir at the end of his life, where Barbara Streisand and stuff was getting her career started and all of that. You know, he's singing the songs she's kind of, you know, Harold Arlen songs. He was singing them when they were new songs, not, yeah, you know, yeah, rehabilitated songs and all that. And so these people are kind of lost to history, you know, and they really had influence. And he was far more, when you look at the Van Vechten pictures of Philip Johnson and Jimmy Daniels, Jimmy Daniels is far more sophisticated than Philip Johnson, who's from Ohio, just has a lot of money coming to New York and all that.
And when did you start putting this information that you were getting through living in Harlem and talking to people who were, you know, also part of the neighborhood? When did you start putting that out into the world, either through walking tours or?
Well, I was doing architecture walking tours. I realized very early that Harlem was not Catfish Row. That for African Americans, it was a great backdrop for, you know, they could look out their windows. The story I was telling about looking out their windows and seeing the Empire State Building. The thing that James Baldwin, he was growing up in Harlem when the Empire State Building was being built. So he saw this frame go up. You saw the cladding go up. You saw the lights go on. It's a world famous building that you're feeling a partnership with New York around all that kind of stuff. So I was collecting postcards and images of Harlem and its physical self. And I was giving tours around architecture. And this woman, Yuen Chin, who's very active in preservation in Harlem, was doing tours. She said, John, I'm getting people interested in Harlem's Jewish history. You should add that to your tour. And I said, well, I don't want to talk about it if I don't really know, if I don't have a hook. I'm not a good storyteller if I don't have a hook. So she told me about this guy who wrote this book, When Harlem Was Jewish. And he was giving a talk in the Lower East Side. And I went down to his talk. And he kept talking about the Jewish displacement of the Lower East Side with the building of the Williamsburg Bridge and the Manhattan Bridges. Took out huge sections of Williamsburg and the Lower East Side, not just for the bridge, but the approaches, the widening approaches to the streets and all that. And I kind of talked to him, oh, this is kind of similar to why blacks were moving up to Harlem. I didn't even talk to him about it at the end of the lecture. You know, the tearing down of the Penn Station area and a big black neighborhood and all that. He kind of like, yeah, like it was really uninterested. I was kind of glad, you know, when I was glad for the revival thing. And then as the architect leaving his talk, which on the Lower East Side, I could see it. I mean, I realized it wasn't hundreds of people, it was thousands of people were being displaced by this big civic project. So I started seeing this parallel. And then I started thinking, well, how could I tell the story? And I started collecting sheet music to see who worked with who. And it's so random that it actually was telling me stuff that I wouldn't know, who, you know, the cross-pollination of who was who. So say for instance, Dorothy Fields is writing, I Can't Give You Anything But Love, Baby. And it's premiering at the Connie's Inn, this club in Harlem. Where father was Lou Fields of Webbers and Fields, who had a theater on 125th Street in Harlem at the turn of the century. She's already a second-generation theater person in Harlem. So she goes on to have a career, and you think of her living on the Upper West Side. They want to put a plaque on the Upper West Side, or she's out in Hollywood. But she's meeting Lena Horne and all these people in the earliest stages of their career. And by the time they go to Hollywood, they have all known each other from this early part of their life during Prohibition in the 30s and all that stuff in New York. So the Jewish neighborhood, the black neighborhood, what's going on. Gershwin, he writes Swanee when he's living at 144th Street between Broadway and Amsterdam Avenue. The only Swanee he had seen is Hudson River, you know. So the fact that that's all sort of part of their DNA and they're talking about, they have this relationship with Harlem and the musicians and all that. The first woman to sing Summertime was Abby Mitchell Cook. And she went in some of these shows that were in the 1890s that went to Europe. And their agents were the agents who built the Apollo Theater. Hertog and Seaman were their agents. And Hertog and Seaman lease is what built the Apollo Theater. So there's all these links across time and that you see. Even like the earliest movie of Rags to Riches is called Humoresque, and it was shot in a movie studio at 2nd Avenue and 127th Street in Harlem that was owned by called Consolidate. It was called Cosmopolitan Pictures because the owner of Cosmopolitan Magazine, William Randolph Hearst, owned the studio. But Joseph Urban did the sets. The same guy who did the sets for that movie did the sets for Showboat. And Showboat's the story has a mixed-race character, Julie, in Showboat, who's passing, but it's written by Edna Ferber, who's Jewish. So she's really telling the Jewish story of passing, and not just the black story. More Jews were passing in 1920 than blacks were passing. You know? So there's this affinity that I see in the Harlem connection and the outsiderness. So my favorite song of that period is Lawrence Hart, My Funny Valentine, because he was short, he was bald, he was gay, he was alcoholic, and all those detriments, is your figure less than Greek, is your mouth a little weak, was his own checklist of his demerits. But everyone connects with that. There's a president that wishes his hands were bigger. There's another candidate probably wishes he was taller, whatever. He's connecting to that outsiderness in us and saying, doesn't matter, don't change your hair for me, not if you care for me. It's like everything you have is wonderful. And that all comes out of a Harlem experience and that interconnectivity of being an outsider but wanting to be an American. And they're writing, they're like politicians, they're writing the slogan of what's going to make us all one. What are we going to give up to be that one in the American? And I sort of feel like even the resentments today go back to what we gave up, self-editing. And we have that resentment from the self-editing. So if you grew up in a household where your mother says, not German, just English, and now they talk about bilingual, you go, well, I had to learn English. It doesn't even get said. But when you go to the voting booth or whatever, those resentments about what you, the threshold you had to cross that maybe somebody else didn't, you know, to be an American, they have to sort of do the, like, the hazing, you know.
Yeah, and some people share that.
And yeah, and some people don't. Yeah. Or they cross over and they think, okay, now I'm American, I'm white, I'm not Jewish anymore, I'm not, or whatever those things were that were demerits, they just shed that, you know. It's like, and blacks can't. So that's why those stories about passing become the sort of immigrant stories, you know.
Pardon me while I check the time. Okay, we only have about 10 minutes.
Okay.
So I guess I would say, you know, I'm happy to hand that over to you. And if you think there's anything that you want to talk about in particular, or I can ask some.
You can ask some more questions. Nothing's burning
sure.
my.
All right. Well, I want to ask you about Harlem Pride.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And I'd like to know the story of how it was formed and also the term same gender loving and how that relates to Harlem in particular.
Well, that was a new term to me until I started engaging in the group. And one of the earlier board members really felt strongly about that term, and he felt that some of the other terms that come out of European culture and sort of defining of gayness and all of that. So there's something that was new to me, but I feel like it was very meaningful to a lot of our audience, and we incorporated that into our title and our acknowledgement of our organization. But I never knew one other player. Our first Pride event was on 119th Street between Lenox and Fifth, and a gentleman had an art gallery, Lawrence, and not Lawrence's last name escapes me at the minute, but Lawrence had an art gallery on that block, and there was a lesbian restaurateur who had a restaurant further over. And it was not long after the 9/11, and you could not get another permit for a street event. You couldn't add any new events to the street. So we knew this woman on the street who was with the Parks Department or whatever, and they did a block fair every year, and they hadn't done it for a while, but she had a slot. We asked, could we use her slot to do our event? And we said yes, and we said we'd have hot dogs for the kids on the street or whatever. And that block was just starting to gentrify. It still had some issues, had drug stuff and all that. And so different friends that came, they said, oh, John, a friend of mine told me, they're just luring you on that street. They're going to beat the people up when they get on the street. And some people couldn't believe there was just an open gay event. They were just so, you know, filled with the idea that this was possible and all of that. And so it really showed us that there was an audience for it. There was a real appreciation for it. And so so we wanted to do it on that street again the next year. But after we did it that year, we had to go back in September after the June one, go back in September and meet with the Block Association. And by then, when we first met with the Block group, it was just a little old lady still trying to hold it together, maybe four, like, aging ladies. But when we went to the one where we had to go and ask what we could do it for the next year, we saw there were way more men there, all of these men. And I could see it wasn't going to bode well. And they started saying, oh, but when we used to have blockers, we used to have pony rides. So we're going to have pony rides. And they started thinking about everything that they used to have ages ago when they were kids. And they didn't have this, they didn't have that. And we could incorporate that. And you know, so you have a church on the block, they could do a flea market. There's all these new people. You wouldn't be, you know, getting money from actually your own block people. Get all the money. Oh, that sounds like a good idea, blah, blah, blah. So they, oh, you couldn't, we don't mind you being here, blah, blah, blah. Then they took the vote. No. And so... And for me, as an African-American male, to know that they did that, even though, I mean, the partner of the art gallery owner, who's a white guy, stood out there and cooked hot dogs and hamburgers all day long for anybody that wanted them and all of that. The smell of smoke spice still in his clothing, for, you know. And so I feel like that was such a giving. I mean, they gave something to us. I don't deny that they made it accessible to us. And it brought something, you know, to their block. You know, maybe that for they couldn't sell drugs at the end of the street for that one day or whatever. But they weren't supportive of it going forward if it wasn't them. And then the next year, they didn't do anything. I'm sure there's no block associated now at all. You know, probably those ladies of all, you know, they're ancient now. It's like, you know. Mm-hmm. So to see that was disheartening mm-hmm. to me, you know. And it was all about gender and, you know, sexuality and mm-hmm. all of that. And so after that, we moved to, where did we go the second? Then we went 1 year in Marcus Garvey Park, and then after that, we were in Jackie Robinson Park until we really outgrew it. And then we knew that Global Pride was coming to New York. And we realized we needed a bigger site, and we moved to 12th Avenue down under the viaduct there, like 135th Street, we're Fairway back there. And we wanted to get there at least 2 years before Global Pride, because we realized we had to get all the kinks out, you know, and permits and stuff like that. And we did, and we got a lot of support from NYC and company. The head of NYC, Fred Dixon, is LGBT, and I'd known him for years. He sort of he moved up through the system there, justly rewarded to be the head of NYC and company. And so he had me do some interviews for magazines and some things around the LGBT culture, and they were very supportive of helping us promote the event. And for us, it was about building audience through social engagement, but also information, exchange of information, because a lot of the groups, you'll see they get ads and they'll put a black ad in there or whatever. But why should African Americans have to go downtown to access information and facilities and or be in environments where certain things are more comfortably talked about and all that? So we really wanted to encourage like testing. All our events, big public events, we have testing and information. Other things that really engage people in their own neighborhood about, you know, accessibility and all of that. But it's just a small core group of us. It's really like a working board. One board member, Jess, stepped down from her job, and she wants to give it, you know, this year, make it more a full-time effort to try to raise more resources around just management and stuff that. But it's been very, very rewarding for my peer group. You know, we're really trying to reach out to even more younger people, but I feel like it's been really appreciated. We get great turnout every year. And we do secondary events. So like the talk I did at the Langston Hughes House about Langston Hughes and his LGBT life, we did that and we broadly advertised that. Like Andrew Dolkart, a lot of people from downtown came to that event because they'd never been in the house. It was a chance to be in the house. So it was talking to my group, but also it's very important to me that we do some networking to resources outside the neighborhood, because a lot of times they don't know, they're not making these kind of connections and stuff. So if I want to write a grant or do something, these players are on those committees and stuff, are well aware of what people are doing and stuff like that. So.
Yeah. And what's the, I guess, the ideal way in which communities with histories who have been marginalized are brought into conversations with people who have more power?
It's just so hard, because it's like it has, the people with the power want to make a genuine effort. A friend of mine was talking to me about talking to minority contractors about how to get, you know, this next election cycle, how to put an agenda forward so more minority contractors get work or whatever. But most of us are starting out in small businesses or small city contracts are the worst things you want, because you have to spend the money, do the work, and get reimbursed for the work. They could drag it out. The governor could just say, well, I want to get more interest on the money and just not pay bills for a month because he wants more interest on money or whatever, and you can't afford to ride that out. So it's really important to have a partner that makes genuine relationships to say, like, I've done work for the Central Park Conservancy, whatever. They know me. They, you know, if I say I need to get an advance or I need you to cover this, I can't wait till the city pays you or whatever. They have a respect for my work and each other that they're going to facilitate whatever that shortfall is and make it work for me or whatever. And so you have to find genuine partners like that. Because if you're just, you know, a contractor knows he has to get 10% minority, and you're in the room where he just says, oh, he does this, and I'm getting in to make this qualification. He could care less whether you sink or swim. He's done his due diligence. That's not a relationship, you know. That's like his cop-out, and he's not going to be there, even though he's like a billion-dollar contractor, and he could give you your $5,000 to meet your payroll, even though the city hasn't paid him. He's just going to tell you, if he doesn't like you, I haven't got my money yet. You have to wait till I get money. So you have to really, there has to be some engagement where people are finding people they really like to work with and engage with, and they want to see growth, or find a partner that they want to see grow with them. Even if you're a modest firm or whatever, you say, oh, I like the work this landscape architect's doing, or I like the report this preservation person did, and realize, I, you know, how can you look around your offices? And when you wait to the crunch to do it, it's a resentment. and you're doing it, and you just found whoever was, you know, I can't find resumes, you bemoan you can't find anybody. But if you look around your office, I've worked with offices where a large percentage is from Syracuse because they went to Syracuse. I feel like, well, okay, if you can do that for Syracuse, why can't you do that? Look around and say, well, we have to go to the schools that have, you know, predominantly black population or historically black schools and say, well, we're looking for interns in the summer, or we're doing this, that. And then you have to be willing to pay. I had a friend that worked for NBC. She said, oh, John, we never get interns, you know, and it's such a great credential, whatever, but they don't pay. So I said, could you imagine me telling my father, oh, Dad, I got a summer internship, and we work at NBC at Rockefeller Center. And he would say, well, John, how much are you going to pay? I say, nothing. So that means he's got to bankroll me through the whole summer to eat in the most expensive area of the city, the transportation, everything. But for a rich kid, they realize it's a benefit for the resume. You know, they'll stay in their grandmother's apartment on Park Avenue for the summer or whatever. It is, if you really want to facilitate that advantage to everybody, you got to figure out a way for the disadvantaged to be able to access some of those same things. And particularly on the cultural hub, museums, everything, it's about this sort of entitlement that they pay you nothing. Even Andre Leon Talley talks about working for Diana Vreeland at the Met. He just did it for nothing. He lived at the Y, whatever. I mean, he had a bigger vision. He would go on to Brown. He kind of understood the value of all that, but everybody does it, you know. And for them to make that hurdle, you have to be willing to facilitate, you know, the things that are going to make it possible for those talented people to get in.
I think we might have to end on that.
Well, okay, that's a good note.
Thank you so much, John.
Thank you. I'm glad it all worked out.